Best Daytime Radio Show at the SA Radio Awards. The Talking Point with Kathy Mutlatlana.
8 after 11 o'clock, welcome to the third and final hour of the show. I do think that there's a lot that we left hanging from that conversation with the public protector. So we are going to have part two of that conversation because there are a number of issues that we didn't get to that include, you know, the reviews that the public protector also would want to have in as far as its own mandate is concerned. What about its remedial action, the powers, its remedial powers? Are there changes to those remedial powers that the institution would want to have reviewed going into the future? And of course, so many of the different issues that you are raising about the institution that I think we just need to do a bit more justice. So we'll invite Niels van der Merwe back to the studio for a part two of that conversation. On that note, we'll get into then our 11 o'clock conversation, and we're going to look at the impact of the public sector strike. And this is in particular on healthcare in rural communities. Russell Rensburg is the director of Rural Health Advocacy Project. Russell, good morning to you. Thanks for your time today.
Oh, thank you, Kathy. And good morning to the listeners.
We have seen the strike take place, of course, in different parts of the country. There have been lunchtime pickets in some areas. It hasn't really been clear the extent to which services have been affected, but I'm talking here about your more urban areas. What has been happening in rural areas, Russell?
So far, the impact hasn't been as extensive as what it could be. You know, I think the manner in which the public sector units have approached these strikes has been very different from previous strikes. So you have like days of action rather than full-out strike action. And to date, we haven't seen major outbursts yet. But we do think that it's something that could be quite volatile and could have an impact on services. If we don't take the necessary precautionary steps now.
As things stand, the Department of Public Administration of Health and others have been urging several sector workers to not go on strike, and this is in particular those that are providing essential services. When it comes to healthcare, what have you seen?
Okay. You know, at the moment, there's no minimum service level agreement in place in the health sector. You know, there's sort of an understanding that all healthcare workers are essential workers and as such cannot strike. But I think sometimes that only extends to medical personnel, you know, so doctors and nurses and so forth. But as you know, it takes more than hospital and doctors and nurses to run a health facility. So when other members that are not covered by the essential services that at the moment go on strike, they can literally bring the hospital to a close, and a lot of different issues get affected, from supply chain to moving people around, reporters, cleaners, and so forth. You know, so I think one of the things that we've been asking is for all the parties to go back to the discussion they had in 2011 and see whether we can resuscitate the introduction of a minimum service level agreement so that when there is a strike, essential healthcare services can be maintained. And workers are very clear about who has the right to strike and who doesn't. And facility managers can make the necessary contingency plans to ensure that healthcare services aren't disrupted.
Have we seen the disruption of healthcare services in rural areas, Russell?
Well, on this day of action, no. But in the past, we have. You know, I mean, I think more recently we've had strikes in the Northwest a couple of years back before the province went into administration. And at that time, you know, we saw facilities literally having to close. Hospitals had to reschedule operations. Healthcare users couldn't access healthcare services because there was a fair amount of intimidation amongst workers and between workers. But I think going forward, we're in a different dispensation now. We must really try and get ahead of these risks and make sure that services aren't disrupted. In the absence of a minimum service level agreement, there is a very strong likelihood that services will be disrupted And in rural areas, that would mean that almost no services will be available because there aren't any alternatives to the public sector.
So effectively, it's a word of caution that you then are raising over this issue. What are the steps that you think should be taken proactively in a moment like this? Because we know that this strike action is only going to intensify. The unions have made it clear that it's not just about that 3% increase that they're dissatisfied with, but they're protesting against a broader principle of collective bargaining that they believe government has betrayed and government has strayed away from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this is exactly what we're saying. You know, government is in a tight position, unions are in a tight position, and everybody, and yes, unions and organized labor have the right to strike, right? I think government has been quite clear when they said that, in fact, they haven't even factored any public sector wage increases. And the current wage increase that they've unilaterally implemented was for the year we're in. You know, so come February next year, they have to renegotiate some of these deals. And we know that currently government is saying they can probably stick to about 3% over the medium term. And I think organized labor is sitting at 10%. And we know that ultimately the cost of living has gone up, interest rates have gone up, workers are considerably poorer. But so is the broader country. And I think the first step is for the unions and government to get around the negotiating table, agree that on a minimum service level agreement, and that is allowed under, I think, under Section 70 of the Labor Relations Act, government needs to issue a declaration on who's considered essential workers and which category of healthcare workers are considered essential workers, so that we can then set up a minimum service level agreement to ensure that essential services are maintained. If they don't do that, right, then we just go into a situation where we don't know where the EMS workers are considered essential, we don't know where the cleaners are considered essential, and so forth and et cetera. So I think the first thing is really about getting the terms of engagement right. We're not party to the strikes, and I'm sure both parties have good arguments as to why they take the positions that they do. I think our interest is the Rural Health Advocacy Project, given that our mission is to promote, protect, and advance the rights to health of rural people in particular. Our interest is in making sure that this industrial action or disagreement between the parties doesn't impact on access to essential health services.
Do you think that there has been enough of an acknowledgement, Russell, of some of the problems that arise at a local level when it comes to access to healthcare, especially in rural areas? Because what we hear about the state of institutions, the state of clinics, in and of itself is problematic. And the healthcare workers will always point to the fact that yes, we can criticize that they don't offer the best service, but they themselves are working under very difficult conditions. And there doesn't seem to be much of an effort to improve those working conditions.
Kathy, I think that's the billion-dollar question. You know, I think healthcare services have been underfunded since 2012, right? We can't sort of wish that away, you know. The biggest portion of healthcare costs is currently salary, right? And I think there has been efforts to increase conditions in the public sector. So in 2010, with the introduction of the occupation-specific dispensation, which has resulted in an increase in salaries for healthcare workers, is never enough. And healthcare workers have done an excellent job in shepherding us through the pandemic. But also within that, you know, that those increases in 2010 and very, very little pedestrian growth in overall health budget means that even though the country is subsidizing the training of healthcare workers and we're adding at least 2,500 new healthcare workers every year, there's no funding available in provincial health budget to expand the health workforce. You know, so I think some difficult decisions need to be made in the wake of the pandemic. And I think we need to get a better understanding of where our healthcare needs are, which are the areas that we need to prioritize, and then work together as a sector to make sure that as we move into this difficult period ahead, that those with the least access get priority to gain access to healthcare services. And similarly, that we make the kind of investment in lower levels of care to ensure that that first contact with the healthcare system can lead to all the health needs of that particular person being met, and that we have a much stronger referral pathway so that we can start looking at how do we contain or manage the cost of running our higher levels of care a little bit better. Because at the moment, I think our healthcare budgets, because they're based on historical funding, are lopsided towards our large footprint of public sector hospitals, which is around 600 at the moment. But we need to find a better way of working with the money that we do have. But I don't think that we can expect all the problems in the healthcare system to be fixed by the stroke of a pen. We need to really start negotiating as a sector on what are the things that we need to start looking at in the short term to improve the responsiveness of healthcare services.
Historically, which have been the services that suffer most during times of protest?
Okay, there's no detailed analysis of that, but I think the services that suffer the most are the ones that are most visible. Right? But so obviously hospital services, those are very visible, and they make media attention because, you know, operations and ambulances and all of those things are not available. But I think the longer-term cost of these things is the breakdown of trust within healthcare teams. Right? Often you have people opposing one another during a strike and then having to go back to work 3 or 4 months later. And sometimes those wounds never heal. Right? And it does affect the broader organizational climate within public sector facilities. There's also very little that they can do at a facility level to contain strike action or manage labor relations a little bit better, because so much of the power is concentrated in the provincial administration. And I think some of the things that we need to do going forward is maybe just look at how do we evolve more decision-making to the local level to allow for some of these engagements and agreements to happen early so that they can make the kind of plans to ensure that we get the right kind of, or at least some kind of maintenance of services during strikes. But these effects aren't always immediately apparent in answer to your question.
What do you do then, Russell? I'm speaking here about an individual like yourself who's working for this advocacy group. You're raising these concerns on a public platform. But beyond this, is there much else that you can do to ensure that it actually ends up with the right, at the right platform, whether it's with the unions, whether it's with government?
Look, I think at this stage, in 2011, we sort of engaged everybody. Right now, I think our interest as an advocacy organization is really to influence processes. And the people that we're reaching out to are the people within national government departments and trying to figure out, is there a middle road here so that we can begin a climate of fair and just negotiations. So I think there are a lot of things happening in the background. Right? But, you know, there isn't always an easy answer to these things. And I think the need for increased media is that it pushes all the parties closer together. Right? I think if we take a position that, yes, we understand that healthcare services are underfunded. Yes, we understand that workers are experiencing pressures. You know, and at the other side, we understand that government is trying to implement the strategy. I think it is a public call to put the patient's needs also at the center of those negotiations. I think it can push both parties closer. But if we take like oppositional approaches, I think that we may make the conflict worse. So I think organizations like ourselves are working in the background. We're also looking for ways and means that we can improve public engagement around this issue. And the more we talk about sort of the implementation of some kind of minimum service level agreement in the general public space, and we can both support for that, I think it also encourages the negotiating party to consider it in their deliberations, because I think currently those interests are not really being fully considered.
Do you have clear reasons for why that doesn't exist yet?
I don't have, well, one of the reasons was, you know, the negotiations in 2011 broke down because the ministers then felt that all healthcare workers were essential workers, and as such, they couldn't strike. So there was no engagement, and I think at that stage the union organized labor were willing to look at a minimum service agreement, right? And there is global evidence for this kind of thing being able and possible. But the former minister was completely opposed to it, and he just shut down the negotiations, and we never got to a point on where it could be agreed or not. I think in the current climate, we have a different minister, union leadership, and I think we can approach the issue in a different way. But at that time, I think what really pushed the thing over the edge was the fact that we couldn't agree that healthcare workers are essential workers or not, and the extent to which strike action is allowed within the sector.
So effectively, you are saying that with a proper service level agreement in place, then you wouldn't have to wonder who would be going on strike when there's a strike taking place. There would be clear descriptions around which part of the hospital staff are not necessarily covered by this umbrella of essential service workers.
Absolutely. Right, and then management can make contingency plan to ensure that those gaps are filled, be it by volunteers like me and you that can go and do clean hospital linen, work in the kitchen or whatever like that. But allow for that localization and for people in support of the strike action to be able to volunteer to do some of the roles that are required to maintain essential access to essential services. And I think one of the things that we do need going forward, as we're probably going to face one of the biggest challenges as a country over the next 5 years, is building more social solidarity around the issues that we have. You know, and I think this could be one of those ways that we can begin that process.
All right. Russell, thank you so much for your time and for being a part of this conversation. Of course, again, the difficulty is that we simply don't know how long this action that is being planned by the unions is going to last. And I suppose the danger is that once it does become a full-on strike, then the concerns that you're raising will come to the fore even more, because that's when we'll feel the full impact of it.
Absolutely. Mm. You know, and I think we need to be proactive and really just get ahead of this. And I think the sooner we can get the parties to actually talk about these issues, the better. And the more pressure we put on them both individually and through the media and broader public comment, I think the closer we can have this issue resolved.
All right. Russell Rensburg is the director of the Rural Health and Advocacy Project, and just speaking there around his concerns when it comes to how then this program of action that has been planned will likely affect the provision of healthcare services, particularly in rural areas. And the fact that there's no service level agreement, right? I didn't even know that. No service level agreement between government and health workers. So currently, the reason why everybody qualifies as an essential worker is precisely because of the lack of this agreement. And he's pushing for the negotiations that are looking into the wage agreements to include a basic service level agreement that will make some of these areas that are murky a lot clearer than they are currently.